Tonight, Dave is going to be speaking on There's a Solution.
There is a solution.
There is a solution. And there is a solution. And won't you please welcome Dave?
Good evening, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a Griffin recovered alcoholic. Ari regrets that she could not make it tonight. She has a terrible migraine. So Jim and I will be covering There is a Solution. Page 17, if you have a book. If you've memorized it, like most of us. Still page 17. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. We are average Americans, all sections of this country, many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joy, when camaraderie, joyousness, democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy and escape from disaster does not subside as we go our own individual ways. The feeling of having shared a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. So who here knows whether or not this chapter was one of the first chapters that were presented when they wrote the original couple of chapters? Because I believe this is part of the original chapter. What Bill is trying to do here, he's given his story. He's going to go on to talk about more about alcoholism in the next chapter. What he's trying to do here is let everybody know that no matter how dire it may look, and in 1937 when they decided to write the book, and 38 when they were actually writing it into 39, there was no answer, right? There was no Dr. Phil show. There was no acupuncture on the beach in Malibu. There was none of this stuff. All the things that we know work so well nowadays. There was, that's just wrong of me to say, but there was really nothing. And alcoholism was seen, don't forget this is during Prohibition days, seen as this pit. And there's no, God forbid you were a dope fiend, because that was even worse than alcohol. You were below the alcoholics, but alcoholics just, they were destined to die. And unless they had a religious experience, they were destined to die. So Bill's making a presentation here, which is going to conflict with everything that people believe wholeheartedly. And he's not only going to make a presentation here about what that means, he's also going to say it's available to all of us. Because he says here, all sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. He's saying that we're all kind of invited. We are people who normally would not mix. Some people think that means men and women, and it may have meant men and women, men and women to Bill, but it also meant a lot of other things to Bill, I think. I think it just meant that we would not have mixed, you know. The Oxford group, which is a group that Bill had been attending to for the first, I want to say about a year or so, 6 months before he met Dr. Bob, and about, I think, 6 months to a year afterwards, and Dr. Bob had been attending to for 2 years prior to meeting Bill, was predominantly kind of middle class, white families, and you'd meet in their homes. And they didn't believe in churches, so you met in homes. And when the alcoholics started coming along, they started putting cigarettes out in the planters, you know. So they didn't quite invite us that much back to the Oxford group meetings. That's a true story, by the way. And Bill's making a presentation here that it's not exclusive to some one group of people or anything else. You know, they're no longer tied to the Oxford group when they're writing this book. The Oxford group would go on to back, you know, make some mistakes in their associations, you know, in the years following the writing of this book. But anyway, so it's one of the things that is meant to really give us hope. Because I don't know about you guys, but when I sat in rehab, I knew that all of you guys, in 1985, all of you guys were going to get better, but I wasn't, because I was somehow different. Even though some of you even looked worse than me. Wow. Which was a hard, hard place to be, right? But I knew that you guys had a shot and I didn't. So to hear this and to believe this, which I wouldn't for 2 weeks until I met another alcoholic who rolled up on me and qualified me in the facility, right? Once he did and he presented the idea that this could happen, I was blown away. Because I didn't think I ever had a shot. I figured jails, institutions, and deaths was my lot.
No, getting into the program as a newcomer, my first grand sponsor was 84 years old, and he had 40 years of sobriety under his belt. And we met every morning at 7:30 in New York, and he would always invite group members out, not for coffee after the meeting, but sushi for lunch. And some days it was just the two of us, but most times there would be the most unlikely group of ragtag alcoholics that you could ever imagine. First of all, with, you know, 25-year-old sitting with an 84-year-old man, and a transvestite, and just everything that you can imagine. And we would sit there, and we'd order sushi. And after he died, I went into the restaurant, and he says, "I never understood what that man was doing with all those people." So, you know, we are the reasons why we're, like, you know, stuck here together is because we have this allergy and the spiritual malaise and mental obsession that when you look at all of them together, you don't need to crash your car into a tree to have this activated. All you need is just a pebble on the street. Just a pebble or someone looking at you the wrong way. We are very fragile beings when we come here, and this is the beginning of learning what it is that we have. Does everybody know what steerage means?
Yeah.
Yes.
Everybody?
Yeah.
Good. Excellent, Dave.
So, you know, it's. Steerage is like the lowest form of travel. Oh. Steerage is like the lowest part in the boat.
Coach.
It makes coach look good. It's like freight. So one of the reasons that Bill uses the boat analogy here is because it wasn't so long before this that the Titanic had struck the iceberg, and there was people, you know, one quarter about it, the people survived. And there was actually, well, I wouldn't call them celebrations, but there were, you know, for years afterwards, there was that common feeling that kept them bound. And if you look at when the plane went down, Scully brought the plane down into the Hudson River. Everyone survived. There was one broken leg and a couple of cuts and bruises. They got together, I know, for 2 years after that on the anniversary. Many of those people, just to honor them. There's that. That's a natural feeling that you know. And I have the guy sitting next to me on the plane. I have no idea who he is, but I'm going to show up at that because it's such a major event in my life. See, with you guys, I got something that I don't have with everybody else out there. I've got a common peril. I got a common problem. I got a common manifestation of this common peril and common problem. And this stuff is what kills me. And I don't know how. I don't know what to do about it. Right. But right next paragraph, they're going to talk about what's going to happen. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. So it's not applicable to just men, just Christians, Jews, Muslims, doesn't matter. Tall, short, smart, wealthy, dumb, poor, broke, doesn't matter. It's a common solution. It's applicable to those of us with alcoholism. Right? There may be people sitting in this room who have a problem with sex, gambling, mild proclivity for heroin and cocaine banging in your neck with a turkey baster. You might have some of these problems, right? But this solution that's being presented in the book is about alcoholism, mm-hmm. right? It's been applied to everything else. You know, it's been successfully applied to gambling problems. It's been successfully applied to sex addiction. It's been successfully applied to many other forms of addictive behavior, right? And it works. But I need to suffer from alcoholism in order to connect with you if you suffer from alcoholism. Because you're not going to believe me, and I'm not going to believe you, unless we can talk about what happened.
And identify.
And it's the identification that brings me together with you. Because I honestly, the first 2 weeks in rehab, I knew everybody was paid. Right? I just absolutely knew everyone wandering that rehab was an actor. And that guy rolled up on me and told me his story, and it was like my story. And it just, okay. All right, you could not have known those things and those feelings and done those things and felt that way unless you're me. We have a way in which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. So this is the first page of this chapter, and it's really all about letting us know that there is a solution to what ails us. An illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it is an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him, right? And no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it there goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone could increase the list. I mean, this guy just took me from page one where I'm like feeling as happy as I possibly can be to like, Jesus, what did I do that?
Yeah.
Yes, I did. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or who have been afflicted. There are many. Highly competent psychiatrists who dealt with us found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wise parents and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. Who's had that experience?
Yeah, go to the shrink and lie to the shrink and lie to myself and leave and wonder why I don't feel relief.
Right. So the next... You want to take the next paragraph?
Okay. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who's properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So later on, we're going to learn about half measures availing us nothing. And right here, it's a warning that we must understand what we have so that we can treat the right thing. Our friend Chris talks a lot about the fact that we often don't know what we have, we don't treat the right thing, and we get lost. But in the... the time-honored tradition of, confession or confiding in others. Just a couple of words have the power to transform a sense of disbelief into true acceptance, which is what Dave was just saying. That the man who was making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he's a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we found most effective. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. And I just add one more. And that is no God that you have to worship. You can have your own God.
Yeah. So I'd like to actually, some of you are well-versed in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous who are sitting here tonight. This paragraph literally is a culmination of their more recent experience in making presentations to people in hospitals and institutions as well as in homes. Bill had found that in the first year, they really didn't get a lot of people sober. They didn't really get a lot of people to come into the Alcoholics Anonymous. They really didn't get a lot of recruits. I think they had four in total. It might have been four or six. And the problem that they had identified was, a lot of times Bill would show up and be holier than thou. It was the problem that he had faced before meeting Dr. Bob, being holier than thou. And I know that for myself, I've suffered from grandiose ideas about me. Far more often than I like to cop to. But the truth is, whenever I do that, I'm not with God. Right? I'm with Dave. That's bad company. Right? And it's in that I don't become attractive to the newcomer. The newcomer doesn't want anything to do with Dave. Right? But when the example of what's happened to me, not by me, but to me, is made an honest presentation of that, everything changes. If we suffer from the same illness.
Oh, want me to
sure.
Okay. Oh, hey. None of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respected homes, occupations, and affairs. All of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort which we're going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that they can give nearly all their time to the work. As I spend more time in the program, I keep finding more and more people who basically make the book, the steps, and the fellowship of the spirit the connecting tissue for a joyous life. And on the other hand, it's impossible. It's impossible to live your life in these rooms only, because then you've given up life. And so we all have things that come along that will challenge us out there, and so we have to digest chunks of truth about ourselves and do this work so that we can recover. Okay.
Okay. If we keep on the way we are going, there is little doubt that much goodwill will result, but the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by, hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Maine could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. Now, don't forget, when this book's written, right? They've got no money, not making any advertisements in newspapers, although that would actually, there'd be a story written about them in the Cleveland Plains Dealer, which would rocket AA into prominence in that area. But there's no easy way of getting the word out. It's all about traipsing to hospitals and talking to doctors, talking to nurses. Do you have anybody that we can talk to? We'd like to be helpful. Chaplains. We have concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problem as we see it. We shall bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with the drinking problem. Of necessity, there will have to be discussions of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. Well, we shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which makes us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Now, I got a question for you. When you rolled into here, your life was completely and utterly on fire. Nothing made sense. They're all after you, you know, and you thought that the end was near, right? You were kind of glad to land here. But if you're anything like me, shortly thereafter, you became a little judgmental. I think he's a little too big book. He's a little not big enough big book. He shares too much. Oh, there she goes again. She's talking about her cat.
The coffee is really bad.
The coffee is bad. The coffee is good. The cookies are gone. How did the cookies get gone? I don't know. Why'd they change the seating? I don't like this place. So what ends up happening for me is I start to figure out ways of separating myself from you guys by elevating myself or lowering you. Typically, I lower myself internally, and I won't voice that. Right? So give me an opportunity by talking about religion, and I will separate myself instantaneously. Doesn't even matter if it's my religion. Give me some sort of medical opinion, and I will have a debate on it, even though I've never stepped foot into a learning facility to learn about medicine. Want to talk about whether or not your sponsee should be on medications or not? Let's have a debate, right? If I know anything, right? So Bill recognized this very early on, and he tries to keep all of this as far away from what's actually going on here, which is a separation from self and a non-duality with God. He's trying to get us back to God. This is the whole thing that came out of the Oxford Group, and this is the whole presentation that he's making, right? It's throughout the steps. And he hated the fact that we had to put in some talk about this, but it was the nature of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1939. People were contentious, you know? You may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us become so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you were curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Right? What does recovered mean? Does it mean that we're cured? No. No. Simply means that if I had a heart attack, you know, a couple of weeks later, I'm up and doing all the things I did before. I've recovered from the heart attack. I'm not cured of having heart attacks. Right? In my case, you know, I think I have as much likelihood of drinking as anybody else. Right? But I do the things on a daily basis to honor the gift of my life with God to not. Right? And it's in that state of freedom from self, that I feel as though I've recovered. And that's why I identify myself that way. It's not something that I did. You know, it's something that's happened to me. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. Okay, so here we go. How many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit?
Impossible.
I never drank like a gentleman. I don't know about you guys. I never quit either. That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine, lay off the hard stuff? Mm-hmm. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to.
My favorite one. She's such a sweet girl.
Yeah. She's a sweet girl, why she's with me. I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. I had that exact experience in 1983. I walked into a doctor's office in Avenel, and I was yellow as a school bus. I had hepatitis, and he says, oh, you have non-A, non-B. It's very serious. You're going to probably have to have your liver die on you, and we need a transplant or something. I said, how long? He goes, we don't know. Maybe 5, 10, 20 years. I said, okay, I'm good. I'll be fine. What could possibly go wrong? Because I'm not going to make it that far. It didn't stop me drinking. Didn't even dent it. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we would hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Who here ever drank with a moderate drinker?
Aggravating.
At times, right? Certainly somewhat boring. What do you mean you're going home?
It's only 2 o'clock.
I know it's my 4th.
You're staring at my half a glass of wine.
Right. Are you going to finish that? Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. Mm-hmm. Who here is known a hard drinker?
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Okay. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker, he may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. What's Bill describing right now for us?
The unmanageability of the disease.
The phenomenon of craving. Phenomenon of craving, right? And being powerless over alcohol. Here is a fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredibly tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day, he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. He's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. But in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a series of senseless sprees.
My specialty.
It's amazing to me that I have, you know, I had this experience where I was drinking quite heavily in my much younger years, and you know, I was fast tracking myself to an insane asylum the way I drank. I was severely underweight, like Bill was. I was 136 pounds when I made it to rehab. I weighed 206 this morning. I was yelling like a school bus, and I was absolutely insane. And you know, what happened many, many years later after coming into the rooms and stopping coming to meetings, and have never done inventory and never done steps, didn't have a sponsor, stopped going to meetings, didn't need you people anymore, wasn't drinking, I started to make the same absurd actions in my life in a different realm and in a different way, and pulled the whole structure down around my family's my family. After having built up a good business, I tore it down based upon ego. Right? The book is very, very accurate. Even though they don't have as many years history as we do now, they didn't have the luxury of the history of being able to look back. They were very prescient in being able to tease out from their experiences with others just how insidious this disease shows up, no matter where it shows up, whether or not I'm actually drinking or not. I don't know if you guys have had that experience, but the disease doesn't leave me because the alcohol has left me. He is the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated you want to sleep the night around. Yet early next morning he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. Who here used to hide liquor? James is just nodding and said, yes, me. Who here used to hide liquor or keep an excessive stash of whatever it was that was your liquor?
I tried. I drank it all.
Yeah.
I
drank
it.
Still fond of it.
Just that trigger with the snow storm. Snowing, I better load up in case the liquor store is on.
That's right.
Trigger.
Yeah? All right. You know, it's funny. I think it might have been 2000. We started this meeting in either March or June of 2010. And I forget the actual month. But I think it was the 2010 to 2011. It was a terrible snowstorm. And my ex-wife said to me, she goes, you going to the meeting tonight? I said, yeah, I'm going to the meeting. I said, newcomer needs to be there. I need to be there for the newcomer. And I wandered down here, and I sat here for 40 minutes. No one showed up. Right? And I had no problem with it. And I wandered back. But I remembered that I went out in snowstorms worse than that to cop. That was just an inconvenience. That did not stop me. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. That was actually Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob would munch pills in the morning so that nobody would notice, and he could prescribe them to himself. No, he could back then. You could prescribe your own medication to yourself as a doctor back then. You could also get liquor. You could also get pure grain alcohol as a doctor during Prohibition.
Health insurance pays for it.
What's that?
Your health insurance will pay for it?
They didn't have health insurance then. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic. I want to stop there and ask the question. Who here was a periodic? Raise your hand if you had an experience in your life where you were periodic. Periodic is somebody, we got one hand up. Periodic is where you'll go for a period of time and just not have anything to do with liquor, and then for some reason you start to drink again.
It's me.
And it just makes sense to drink again the next day, or that night you just keep going, or some, and then I'm going to stop, and then I don't stop. And it goes for a few months, and then something interferes with me, and I stop. But once I begin that cycle, I can't. And my periodic, I don't know about you guys, would be I would get drunk for a period of time. I'd crash a car. I'd stab a friend. You know, the typical stuff. I would, you know, I'd rob somebody, and I'd get caught and get in trouble, and then I'd cease and desist. And the first time I had a cease and desist, you know, I did the marijuana maintenance, but I ceased and desisted for some period of time. But each period of time got smaller and smaller and smaller. I finally had to leave New Jersey and go to California and live on a beach, right, to cease and desist. I had no choice. I couldn't do it here anymore. That 18, I couldn't stop of my own accord. It was periodic. I would go for periods of time and appear to not be a drinker. And I'd even have enough experiences where I went and appeared to be a heavy drinker, a partier, but not an alcoholic. But inside of me, I knew exactly what the game was. Because I would end up many nights in Staten Island, you know, where the bars were open to 4 o'clock, against my will. And I never, ever knew what night that was going to be. But Bill describes it in the book as a guy who just can't stop drinking. But that's not true. Many of us have these periods. Right? I think the reason that Bill has this in the book is because he really got the vestiges of the hard-bottom people. You know, you had to be a real rum hound for Bill to run across you in 1938, 30, you know, 39, 37. Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, you know, for me, there is, you know, vodka and morphine don't work out too good. And, you know, I just, for me, it's a downward spiral. The substance always ended up being alcohol again and again and again. And I just didn't know it was happening. I thought other things were happening. I didn't know what I had. Shall I continue?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say this one short paragraph, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, comma, as our behavior patterns vary, period. But this description should identify him roughly, right? We're not heavy drinkers, and it's important for us when we qualify somebody who walks into these rooms and we say, you know, do you belong here? Let's sit down and have a conversation. Why keep them in the rooms if they're a heavy drinker? You want to hang out, fine, but just don't identify as an alcoholic. Go to open meetings. But if you're an alcoholic, please don't leave. We love you and want to help you. But if you're a heavy drinker and you start to sponsor people, you're not going to have the commonality. You don't have to share with them what has happened to you that's happened to us. Hmm. If you're a moderate drinker and you're here, you certainly got problems beyond what we can help you with. Because why the hell would you come here for the coffee and the cookies? Come on. But many people get stuck in here as heavy drinkers, thinking that they've got a problem. And I've seen people qualify with 20 plus years who go, I'm not an alcoholic. Leave and have a good life. But they got pushed in here at 16 or 18 or 20, told they were an alcoholic because they had had a rough patch, right? And never left. And I'm not suggesting anybody go out and drink. Don't take it the wrong way. I'm just saying that at the end of the day, our nature is that we really need to band together or die separately if we're alcoholic. But one of the things that I've seen separate us is having people who don't belong here.
Yeah, if you drink too much, drink less. But that's not us.
Right.
We're alcoholics. We're powerless over alcohol. And we can't drink less. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its intended suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he sometimes displays with respect to other matters? What is missing here is that no amount of willpower is going to cure my alcoholism, and common sense doesn't even enter the equation. Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We're not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. Well, what is the certain point? What is that certain point? Is that the invisible line where you just, because it's going to go in and talk about how we set the cycle in motion. Dave's the certain point. What is the certain point?
You know, so my guess here, I'll tell you what my certain point is. My certain point probably started before I started drinking. I honestly believe that I was going to drink alcoholic no matter what. I don't believe that I wandered into alcoholism by a series of bad drinking habits. You know, I honestly believe that I was born that way. It just doesn't seem like I ever wanted to. I don't know about you guys, but when I first got drunk, I'm like, again, like that feeling. Don't ever want to lose that feeling. Do that again. That's not everybody's story, right? My certain point started early on. But I've seen, you know, it always shocks me when a guy goes, you know, I was getting my master's at Princeton, and, you know, I found myself drinking earlier on Saturday night, and it was a problem. I'm like, you went to high school? You know, you don't have my kind of alcoholism. You may have alcoholism, but you don't have my kind of alcoholism, because mine's like, come here now. Let's have a party. And, you know, that doesn't make him less of an alcoholic than me, mm-hmm. or me different, right? It just means that it manifested differently. And once again, I think that Bill's working with, you know, really hard cases early on, because you don't end up in the jitter joints of those days unless you're really jittery. You know, no psychiatrist suggested you wander over to Dr. Bob's house, you know, and have a coffee with Ann Smith. You know, read a few passages from the Bible in those days. You know, it was like that man needs to be locked up, and that's when Bill would meet you. So your certain point looked like you may have, many of these people had money, because if you didn't have money, you didn't end up in the hospital. Right? You ended up in the gutter. Don't forget, this is the Depression times. So certain points looked like people who had been successful for a while and then fell off a cliff. That's my best guess.
We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. And we talked before about you know, what is it that that separates us from civilians and also unites us, and it's. This is the thing right here. We have this allergy to alcohol in bodily and mental sense, which makes it impossible for us to do anything but betray ourselves. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. We could spend the rest of the night on this. How many people have found that they can recognize their alcoholic thinking without drinking in sobriety? Right. We're going to find out about fear and resentments and harms and you know, character defects that all feed into this. But for me, I'm sure that, you know, in first grade, when we went out to the ball field and I was the last kid picked, I was ready for a drink. You know, I was ready right then. And when I got back into the classroom, I would sit in the back row and hide from the teacher because I was emotionally torn up, spiritually torn up, and I had no, you know, I had a sobriety problem, and I needed a drink. Okay.
If you ask him why he started on that last, that's where we're at, right?
Yep.
If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Who's done that? Raise your hand. Right. Right. Sometimes his excuses have a certain plausibility. It's because of her. But none of...
Because of him.
That's right. My job was to be the him.
Because of
but
him.
None of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. How true is that? They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. How often have I been presented with the truth of my existence and it has pissed me off? How many times has someone showed up and says, you know, Dave, you're a tad arrogant. Go fuck yourself. You know, you know, Dave, you might think, well, really? Really? Coming from you or from you or from you? Really? The truth, my delusion that I can manage or control my life has a bevy of tools against the truth. The problem is none of them really exist. None of them really have power until I agree to listen to them. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time. But in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. I got to tell you something. When I was out doing the deal before I went into rehab, I had no idea. I finally had to come up with one final answer for me was that I was a broken unit. I was defective, right? I was one of the God's mistakes. And the best thing I could do is stick a gun in my mouth. And then they pushed me into rehab, psych hospital first, because of disagreement with a police officer, but into a drug and alcohol unit, and you people told me that I suffered from alcoholism. And that ruined it, right? Because I couldn't lie to myself anymore about what was ailing me. It wasn't you people anymore. It wasn't them. It wasn't something that was unquantifiable. You ever hear somebody say, you know, I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and it went back out and it ruined my drinking?
Yep.
Did the same thing for me when I drank in 2002. Ruined it. I knew. And here's the crazy thing. That same bottle of wine that got me as drunk as any other alcohol ever did didn't solve one single goddamn thing. That was disappointing. If something had been fixed, I'd still be drinking. Or dead.
You know, on 151, at the beginning of A Vision for You, it talks exactly about this, you know, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, the isolation, and withdrawing from the world. I can't show up. I can put my bow tie on. I can even get in the car. I can even show up at work. But when I get to work, I'll be hiding from everybody, and I'll be like doing this with my stuff. Like I'm working. Excuse me, I'm working. I'm very busy right now. And that's the best I can do.
You know, the funny thing is, we're at this point where we're the baffled lot, right? We have no idea why. Mm-hmm. But that's not how this chapter started, is it? This is, there is a solution. It was one of the happiest pages in the book, just about. Oh my God, this is going to be a great chapter. Oh my God, we're a baffled lot. Bill's a great wordsmith. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. And I knew that in the end. I remember 2 years before I was incarcerated, I remember I was at my mom's house, and I just said, I don't have any control left. I'm going to ride this train to the end and see what happens. And what happened was incarceration. How true this is, few realize. In a vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal. But everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will. Old power of will. I just couldn't find it. The tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Raise your hand if you remember those times. Dave's like, yeah. I'm back here. This is me. The tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected.
And that's the certain point.
That's a certain point. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. We are without defense against the first drink. Right? The state that I'm in when I'm not with God, when I'm self-directed, is that I have no ability to defend myself against my disease. None whatsoever. I'm going to end up in a place where that drink is going to look better than you people. And that's been my experience. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind or deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazily and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we should handle ourselves like other people. Right. Not suffering from the common peril or the common manifestation or the common problem. Not suffering from these things like other people who don't suffer from them. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way and after the third or fourth pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, for God's sakes, how did I ever get started again? Only to have that thought supplanted, but well, I'll stop at the sixth drink. Well, what's the use anyhow?
Yeah, my personal favorite, what's the use anyhow?
I had a lot of tomorrows. When I was drinking, you ever sit in the bar stool and go, you know, I had that, you know, I forget what, pet rock. I had that pet rock idea. Well, I'm going to do something about that tomorrow. Right? It was always tomorrow. I'm going to stop drinking tomorrow. I'm going to get that job tomorrow. I'm going to pay that drug dealer back tomorrow. You know? I'm going to do something tomorrow that I'm not going to do today. The funny thing is, in a recovered state, my life today is so busy on any given day of doing stuff with family, with friends, Alcoholics Anonymous, staying in shape, getting in shape, cleaning up the house, doing stuff that I just never thought would be fun. I'm excited about this. It's crazy. I don't care about tomorrow. I care about right now, the here and now. But I lack all power, choice, and control once I start drinking. Right? It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Anything that might happen isn't going to happen soon enough for me. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but cannot. Jim, I think you actually came with me. Remember the time we went to Jersey City to the hospital?
Yeah.
What's his name, Rocco?
I forget.
Let's call him Rocco. That's okay. Probably not his name because I have no idea who I talk to anymore.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful fellow alcoholic, but he had placed himself in a position just like this book just talked about, right? Permanently insane, a moment away from permanent insanity. And sitting there and talking to him and giving a presentation out of the book, you could see the light come on in his eyes. And the moment we left, the light dimmed. Right? No longer had the hope or the belief. Permanent insanity is believing that my lot in life will never change. And it's bad at the time that I decided it will never change. Right? You ever see the movie What Things May Come? Robin Williams. And there, both he and his wife die, but she commits suicide and goes to hell. And he dies in an accident and goes to heaven. And he decides to make the journey to hell to try to save her. But nobody's ever brought somebody out of hell. Right? And he goes down there, and it's just a pit of hopelessness. That's what this particular place in hell was, a pit of hopelessness. And that's what I remember my alcoholism being. And I remember seeing this movie for the first time, I started to cry. Because Robin Williams makes the decision in the movie. I don't want to ruin it for those of you who haven't seen it. But makes the decision to stay with her. He goes, I'd rather be with you in hell than live in heaven. And that's what saves her. And that's really what saved me, was somebody would rather come and be with me and give to me what was given to them so freely to bring me out of that place where I believe in hopelessness. Right? I believe that my lot is hopelessness. That there is no better tomorrow. Right? Hopelessness is that tomorrow could not be better than today. Because that would be hope. And I knew that was my lot in life. But Bill's now going to throw it at us. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride. That's the hard one, right? I don't know about you guys, but I had trouble with that one. I still have trouble with that one. The confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for a successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had to come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had never even dreamed.
I remember the first time I read that, I said, oh, come on.
Yeah.
You know, I argued a lot with this chapter. And it's my experience today that you know, without a higher power in my life, I could not self-search. I would run from myself. I would try to race against the wind so that I wouldn't feel my feelings or have that mandatory admission or concession to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, that I am an alcoholic. And leveling of my pride, false pride, real pride, doesn't really matter. And, of course, confession of shortcomings. I was either better than you or much worse, and it was impossible for me to move from that point. A lot of contempt prior to investigation, and that's, you know, with a spiritual experience of coming in here and realizing that I'm part of the first word in this chapter, which is we, that my life can actually change, and it has changed. And I'm sitting up here telling you that because it's the truth.
So, you know, anybody here have a description of what the fourth dimension looks like? No, it's in the book, at least as far as I can tell. I'll read you one of the descriptions. I'll read you one of the descriptions of it. I don't know what the fourth dimension actually could be described for me, but I'll read you one of the descriptions of what the fourth dimension looks like in my life. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. By this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor, if tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We will act sanely and normally, and we will find this has happened automatically. The promises for me are a description of what the fourth dimension looks like. Right? We will know a new freedom and a new happiness. Right? These are the manifestations of what it looks like to be free of self. These are the manifestations of what it looks like in my life to finally have gotten with God after all this time of being with self and finding out that it just doesn't work to be with me. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. Oh, that's explained in the appendix.
A synopsis of the appendix is that some of us got hung up on Bill's comment of having a white light experience and suddenly, you know, instantaneously he had a conversion to belief in a higher power. And so many of us have what the appendix calls the educational variety, where we're constantly discovering stuff. And for me, I used to judge because I'm a slow. I used to judge myself all the time. Oh, I should be better than this. I should be further along. I should be whatever. And now I just realize that it's a lifetime adventure. Recovery is a lifetime adventure. So there's always something to learn, always something to do. And, yeah. Yeah.
The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. What else is there? Right? Revolutionized. That's not, we painted the house. This is that we tore the house down, there was a new structure, right? Mm. The whole thing is about a total new experience. When you read promises in the book, the word new is very often found. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. Right? The theme has always been that when I'm self-directed, I'm in trouble. I have the most insane person in the room at the helm. And that's been my story. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region for which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. And I always hated this, right? I don't know about you guys, but this really pissed me off. One was to go to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, right? And the other was to accept spiritual help. Even the length of the sentence for accepting spiritual help is far shorter than what's going to happen if I don't accept spiritual help. And I still want to know, well, what does this look like, this bitter end? You know, is this like a 5-week journey, or is this a 5-month or a 5-year thing? Will I get laid? You know, what's going to happen? You know, what's going to happen in this journey? I mean, I'm pondering this stuff. Because I don't have any knowledge, and it scares the crap out of me not to be self-directed. My delusion does not want to let go of the idea that it somehow is going to be different tomorrow if I just learn, I read a new self-help book, or learn something new in how I conduct myself, or if you just leave my life, or you just enter my life. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. Yes. A certain American businessman had good ability, good sense, and high character. I'm going to kind of blow through this kind of quickly, this one portion, so we can get to the important part. For years he had floundered from one sanatorium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placed himself in the care of celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Roland Hazard. If you haven't heard of Roland Hazard, spend a couple of minutes on the internet tonight and look up the story of Roland Hazard. Son of a wealthy industrialist in the Northeast. Gets on a train after spending a full year with Dr. Jung, and he's not drinking, right? Gets on a train. He's going to go to the coast and catch a boat to go to England to catch another boat to come back to the United States, recovered from his alcoholism. He stops in Paris to have dinner with some friends, and he's drunk. God, I know, I want to party with that man, you know? Nevertheless, he's drunk in a short time, Paris. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to this doctor. He got back on the train. So he returned to this doctor whom he had admired. And it's in point blank, but he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society. He would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was a great physician's opinion. You know, Dr. Jung believed that... he was different than Freud. And Freud and Jung were the two big names in talk therapy at the time. There was actually a movie about that not too long ago. But Jung believed that we could become more as humans. We could evolve. That's what Jung believed. Freud believed you need to get okay with who you were. Now, if Roland had made it to Freud, I don't know that I'd be sitting here today. If you think about what it took for you and I to be in this room tonight, Freud wouldn't see Hazard. He was either too busy or something else, because they had gone to Freud first. And he ended up with Jung. And Jung gives him the truth. But this man still lives and he's a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on the earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let's tell you the rest of the conversation, and here we go, our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, "You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you." Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. Imagine sitting there. There's never been an answer to alcoholism. This guy just told you, you're screwed. He said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" "Yes," replied the doctor, "there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. Phenomena are things that are rare and aren't explainable or easily explainable. They appear to be the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side. And a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. What he's telling us right here is whatever I bring to the table on day one in Alcoholics Anonymous is best discarded. You ever sit with a sponsor who goes, no, hold on, let me explain that. No, how about this? Shut up. Just shut up. You're wrong. But as you say it nicely, though, of course. What I brought into my life, probably until the 26th year, was self-direction based upon broken ideas. Broken ideas. In fact, I've been trying to produce such emotional rearrangement within you. With many alcoholics, the methods which I employ are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description.
A lot of times I hear people saying, like, I got to figure out something or figure, you know. But this talks about the fact that a lot of this is just metaphysical. It's spiritual. It's, you know, I call it cosmic even. That's why discarding subtraction is much more useful to create space for whatever's going to happen to you will happen.
Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctors telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. So, what I take away from that, and what has been apparent in my life, is that knowledge of my alcoholism or knowledge of a spiritual path doesn't solve my problem. I actually have to journey down the spiritual path. Here is a terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experiences which we have already told you made him a free man. We, in our turn, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, if you prefer, a design for living that really works. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book, Varieties of Religious Experiences, indicates a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. Doesn't it tell us in how it works that willingness and honesty are indispensable?
Mm-hmm. Right. Spiritual experience. Open-mindedness also.
Right. Throughout this book, right, we're going to find, right, I have to be willing to have a new experience, and I have to be honest about what my current condition is. And those are two really hard things for me. You know? It's all gradations, movements forward, backtracking and moving forward. But without it, I have no shot. Those having religious affiliations will find here nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. We think it no concern of ours what religious bodies our staff members identify themselves, our members identify themselves with as individuals. This should be an entirely personal affair with each one decides for himself in the light of his past associations or his present choice. Not all of us join religious bodies, but most of us favor such memberships. In the following chapter, there appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it. Then a chapter addressed to the agnostic. Many who were once in this class are now among our members. Surprisingly enough, we find such convictions no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. Clear-cut directions. They are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in their own language and their own point of view the way he establishes his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. 42 stories about alcoholics destroying their lives, not in bad taste. Right? How could that be? Oh, wait, they all got sober. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages and will believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that there will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them. I must have this thing. Can you want to close?
Yeah, we belong to a class of people that we have this common solution, this common peril, and we have this fantastic text that gives us the spiritual path and directions that we need. And if you're anything like me, it's the last thing in the world I want to do. Even though it's going to give me peace, health, etc. And so my idea is I have to be broken down. And coming into, it's a great way to come into AA, to be completely broken so that my ego can't reassert itself too quickly, and I can remain teachable and try to do something which I never could do in my whole life, which is have an ounce of humility in my body. And how great it is to be with all of you and part of this community to meet on Sunday nights and go through the book and we experience the miracle together, and then when we walk out of here, at least when I walk out of here, I feel refreshed, I feel rejuvenated, and I feel like I did the right thing, which is to address today in the present moment my alcoholism as it exists today. With no shoulds, no condemnation. As soon as I start condemning myself, this all goes out the window. And it's all about, like Dave said, this is the miracle for people like us. Thank you very much, everybody. Great meeting.
Great. Nice to be closing.